Our guest this hour comes from Europe, but has a serious warning for America and the Western world. She urges us not to make the mistakes of Europe. That's next.
I'm the dealmaker, and as the dealmaker, I know what makes a deal. And I have said in The Art of the Deal that sometimes a deal is not possible. And I'm telling you, as the dealmaker in chief of the world, this is an issue where a deal isn't possible for this reason, that you cannot make a deal with people whose basic premise, whose basic proposition is one that no civilized person should accept at all, and that is the destruction of the State of Israel. And so therefore, given that you, the Palestinians, are still set on this appalling aim, there will be no deal from me, no negotiation at all. You will get nothing from America. You will get no money. You will get no diplomatic recognition. We will no longer regard you as statesmen in waiting. You are not. You are terrorist supporters and people who wish to exterminate another people. As such, you'll be treated as political and diplomatic pariahs.
This is Understanding the Times Radio with Jan Markell. This hour, Jan and co-host Eric Barger meet with British journalist, author, and public commentator, Melanie Phillips. Melanie is here to discuss the political situation in the United Kingdom, Europe, and the United States. Melanie Phillips started on the left of the political spectrum, writing for The Guardian and New Statesman. During the 1990s, she came to identify with more right-wing ideas and currently writes for The Times, The Jerusalem Post, and The Jewish Chronicle. She covers political and social issues from a social conservative perspective. Phillips defines herself as a liberal who's been mugged by reality. To get the conversation started, here's Jan Markell.
Welcome to the program. You know we look at news, views, truths from a decidedly biblical perspective. I have an interesting hour for you this week. I want to talk a little bit about my guest by way of introduction. Her name is Melanie Phillips, and she's one of the few British media voices sounding the alarm as the nation steadily gives way to the dictates of Islamic law. And she has an important message to Americans. So we're going to talk about that. In 2016, London became the first major Western capital to elect a Muslim mayor. I personally think that that is very significant. And she's written a number of books, including Londonistan, How Britain is Creating a Terror State Within, and another book titled The World Turned Upside Down. We'll talk about how you might obtain those likely on Amazon here as we move along in the hour. And Melanie's books and her weekly columns continue to warn of the imminent demise of Western civilization in its Judeo-Christian form unless something is done. She also writes for the Times of London, the Jerusalem Post, the Jewish Chronicle. She's a regular contributor to UK radio, TV discussion. Her views, by the way, are considered controversial. Eric, I know you have been preparing for this hour. He's in studio with me. Your thoughts?
Well, as I watched the YouTubes, I found myself saying amen more times than not, stopping and re-listening, and she's got some interesting points, and the way she says them, I think, are so important. So I hope folks will listen up. This is going to be great.
Melanie Phillips, welcome to America. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
You are doing some speaking across country?
I am. I have been traveling across the country. I started in California. I was then in Oklahoma, then in Des Moines, Iowa, and here, and I'm going on to New York and so on. And so it's been a very interesting tour.
You're speaking to conservative groups, to mixed groups?
A variety of groups. I'm speaking to some Jewish groups based in synagogues. Mm-hmm. I've been speaking to conservative groups as well. Well, and some Christian groups.
How are you received?
Pretty well. One or two people have, you know, made it clear that they don't agree with what I'm saying. That's absolutely fine. But by and large, I've been speaking to people who are broadly on side. Mm-hmm. I used to worry that that was like preaching to the converted, and that it used to worry me that the people who don't agree with me don't turn up. But they don't turn up because they will not engage with the arguments. They prefer just to demonize the people who oppose them. But I came to realize some time ago that actually preaching to the choir was not something that was to be sneezed at, because the choir is very beleaguered, the choir is very besieged, and the choir is in danger of forgetting or even not knowing the lines of the song that they should be singing. Mm. So I've come to realize that I do play a role, I can play a useful role in telling them stuff that maybe they don't know or they've forgotten or they're too frightened to hear, and basically giving them a kind of encouragement just by the fact that I'm speaking up in public as far as I can. It makes them feel they're not alone, and I believe that's a useful thing that I can do.
Well, I remember when your book, London Afghanistan came out, and that's a few years ago. It's over a decade ago that it came out. I remember it very well. And when it came out, there was no Arab Spring. Hadn't happened yet. There was no war in Syria. Hadn't happened yet. The mass migration to Europe, that's of the last 3-4 years, hadn't happened yet. But you obviously had a significant Muslim population in London, because you were talking about, back then when you wrote this book, an Islamic State before there was an Islamic State.
Well, what was worrying me at the time, and this was in the wake of 9/11, obviously, yeah, when I think virtually all of us kind of woke up to the fact there was such a threat. What then became apparent to me over the following few years was that the British political and intellectual establishment was not only not dealing with this threat, mm-hmm, but wasn't prepared even to identify it as the threat that it was, based in what I consider to be a form of religious fanaticism, a particular interpretation of Islam, which had taken hold in the Islamic world and was backed by the most powerful forces in the Islamic world, and which was setting out to Islamize the non-Islamic world and to Islamize also, or to re-Islamize, the Islamic world that wasn't considered Islamic enough. And what concerned me was the way in which Britain was making itself a haven for the most extreme, mm-hmm, voices, mm-hmm, in this
way
world.
Way back then. Yeah, mm-hmm. Before all this immigration issue even began. I mean, the serious immigration crisis.
Yes, well, Britain had an immigration of people mainly from Pakistan and Bangladesh, okay, who were Muslim. And those people who came into Britain were fine. They were people who came for work. They came typically from poor villages,
sure,
in Pakistan and Bangladesh. They weren't particularly pious. They weren't particularly religious. They simply wanted a job and a peaceful life. What we didn't realize, what Britain didn't realize at the time, was that they brought with them religious institutions which had been radicalized, mm-hmm, in Pakistan and Bangladesh. They had been radicalized by the Saudi-based Wahhabi interpretation of Islam, which is the interpretation of Islam which is jihadi Islam. It's militant, it's aggressive, it believes in Islamizing the people who are not Islamic enough or not Islamic at all, and they're the people who cause us the most problems today. And they brought with them, the immigrants to Britain brought with them the institutions that have been radicalized by this Wahhabi version of Islam. And as a result, the children who were born in Britain, okay, became more radical than their parents, because the children went to the mosques and the madrasas, which were staffed, sure, by people who were radicalized in this way, education institutions. And even though the vast majority of these children were educated in British mainstream schools, nevertheless, the influence was a radical one from the religious point of view.
Wahhabism, as we know, they were the 9/11 pilots. They were the people who engineered the attack. And that's something that can't be stressed or forgotten, I believe, enough. We need to remember that. Did you find in the beginning, when you were speaking out about this, you must have felt like you were all alone in some cases. You were the only one that was warning anyone there. And we felt the same way here as we began to warn about Islam. People looked at us funny, like, it can't really be that bad. It can't all be like this. Is that what happened to you? And did the media kind of drive this at the same time to make you look like that this was, you were more fanatic than maybe you even felt you were?
Very much so. I was considered to be absolutely on the extreme edge of discourse, that I was being alarmist for no good reason, that I was demonizing an entire population. And this was despite the fact that I actually have always, in everything I've ever written and said about this Islamic problem, I've always emphasized that we cannot generalize, that there are many millions of Muslims, mm-hmm, who do not subscribe to this particularly extreme interpretation of Islam. Many of them came to Britain because they were fleeing from it. They wanted to live under Western human rights. They wanted to live in peace and security and raise their children, have good jobs, and just have a nice life. And the majority of people even today who are the victims of this terrible Islamic extremism are in fact Muslims. But at the same time, what we're living through, what we've been through, and what we're still living through, is a situation in which our leaders, our political leaders in Britain and America and in mainland Europe and elsewhere, just deny that this thing has anything to do with Islam. Mm-hmm. I mean, in my view, this is an interpretation of Islam. It's a particular interpretation. It's not subscribed to by everybody, but it is rooted in the theology. It has theological sources. And it's ridiculous to say it's got nothing to do with Islam. And our leaders deny this. And, you know, if you can't even name properly the thing you're up against, if you can't accept and acknowledge that what you're up against is religious fanaticism, which is a different order of magnitude completely, a different type of threat from any other threat, when people believe they're motivated by the defense of God, which is what they believe they are, then if you don't understand that, you cannot possibly deal with it properly.
You're listening to Understanding the Times Radio. I'm Jan Markell. I have in studio with me Melanie Phillips. I'm going to give you the rundown of what her credits are again a little bit later. Again, I got familiar with her over a decade ago, Londonistan, when that came out, about 2006. Eric Barger in the studio with me. We're talking to her about, well, quite frankly, it's sort of a subtitle of the book, Londonistan. It's really a warning to America about all who care about freedom. And obviously, Melanie, Europe is going through some some trials. Now, what I read in your book, what I read online, in Britain, God is pretty much dead. Now, God didn't die, but Great Britain and other parts of Europe have thrown him out. And they've replaced him with superstition, replaced him with government, replaced him with multiculturalism, replaced him with diversity. And I even read where some are, instead of God, they're turning to witchcraft, they're turning to psychic activity, they're turning to astrology. In other words, anything but God. Churches are being turned into mosques. I mean, this is a serious warning to the Western world, to our part of the world, United States and Canada. Serious warning.
Well, I think you put your finger on it. And indeed, I developed these precise themes in my subsequent book, which is published 4 years after Londonistan, called The World Turned Upside Down, The Global Battle Over God, Truth and Power. And what I say in that book is that two things have happened in the West which feed into each other. One is the systematic erosion of Western national identity and the Western values, which are based on the Hebrew Bible and Christianity. And they have been replaced by a whole lot of secular ideologies or isms, moral and cultural relativism, multiculturalism, and all kinds of other ideologies. These ideologies, if you drill them down, they all have a common core, which is the despising of and the desire to undermine and overturn the core values of Western society, which are based on the Hebrew Bible and on Christianity. And these ideologies brook no dissent, because they drive all before it, because they are ideologies where the power of the idea drives all before it. It cannot be gainsaid. It cannot be challenged. And the reason it can't be challenged is because it's not just an idea. It's not just a point of view. It's a point of view that is considered to stand proxy for virtue itself. If you believe in multiculturalism, for example, you are motivated by the desire to make a better world based on the erosion of bigotry. Bigotry only comes from people being divided, so you avoid division by saying that no culture can consider itself to be superior to any other. And that way you basically get rid of bigotry from the human heart. Who could possibly disagree with that? Well, I would disagree with that, because I personally think the West's values, based on biblical morality, are better than anyone else's values. Yeah. But if I say that under the doctrine of multiculturalism, I'm a bigot and a racist and a phobe and all the rest of it. These ideologies can't be gainsaid. You cannot argue against them. And as a result, not only are they destructive of the basis of our Western society in and of themselves, but they bring about inexorably a situation where they stamp out dissent. They are innately totalitarian. They cannot brook any dissent. So if people dissent from these ideologies, they can't be permitted to have an alternative point of view. They have to be basically run out of the public square altogether. So in order to do that, anybody who stands up for, who stands up against moral relativism or multiculturalism or whatever it is, they have labels put around their neck. Phobe, bigot, xenophobe, racist, white supremacist, fascist, Nazi, all of those labels. Those labels act as a kind of warning to everybody else. Don't go there. Don't listen to this person, because this person is a really bad person, and if, heaven forbid, this person's view should ever gain traction, then the world will become a terrible place.
You can learn a lot more, folks, at Melanie's website, melaniephillips.com, melaniephillips.com. Again, she writes for the Times of London, the Jerusalem Post, the Jewish Chronicle. She lives in the UK, Great Britain. And Melanie, the thing I'm observing from a distance, obviously, is Europe kind of committing suicide. And I do want to ask you about Emmanuel Macron a little bit later. But I want to play a short soundbite and get your take on it, because the soundbite talks about, and we're still dealing with this Islam situation, with the demographics involved with Islam. We don't have to do much of anything. And within 30 years, Europe could be completely Islamicized. I want to play this quick soundbite and then get your response, please.
According to research, in order for a culture to maintain itself for more than 25 years, there must be a fertility rate of 2.11 children per family. With anything less, the culture will decline. Historically, no culture has ever reversed a 1.9 fertility rate. A rate of 1.3, impossible to reverse, because it would take 80 to 100 years to correct itself, and there is no economic model that can sustain a culture during that time. In other words, if two sets of parents each have one child, there are half as many children as parents. If those children have one child, then there are one-fourth as many grandchildren as grandparents. If only 1 million babies are born in 2006, it's hard to have 2 million adults enter the workforce in 2026. As the population shrinks, so does the culture. As of 2007, the fertility rate in France was 1.8, England 1.6, Greece 1.3, Germany 1.3, Italy 1.2, Spain 1.1. Across the entire European Union of 31 countries, the fertility is a mere 1.38. Historical research tells us these numbers are impossible to reverse. In a matter of years, Europe as we know it will cease to exist. Yet the population of Europe is not declining. Why? Immigration. Islamic immigration. Of all population growth in Europe since 1990, 90% has been Islamic immigration. France, 1.8 children per family. Muslims, 8.1. In southern France, traditionally one of the most populated church regions in the world, there are now more mosques than churches. 30% of children ages 20 and younger are Islamic. In the larger cities such as Nice, Marseille, and Paris, that number has grown to 45%. By 2027, 1 in 5 Frenchmen will be Muslim. In just 39 years, France will be an Islamic republic. In the last 30 years, the Muslim population of Great Britain rose from 82,000 to 2.5 million, a 30-fold increase. There are over 1,000 mosques, many of them former churches. In the Netherlands, 50% of all newborns are Muslim, and in only 15 years, half of the population of the Netherlands will be Muslim.
Melanie Phillips, your comment to that?
The basic facts are correct. The populations in Europe are not reaching replacement rate. Mm-hmm. So the indigenous population is effectively dying out, and Muslims are having babies in much larger number. So if nothing else changes, that, you know, that prognosis is correct. But there is a factor here which I think is being overlooked, and where I think I have actually a ray of hope as a result of recent events. It's quite correct to say that if the demography is against you, if you're not replacing your own culture, then that society will die out. Demography drives culture. But culture also drives demography. And the question is why all these countries have stopped replacing themselves. Mm. And you could argue that it's to do with the role of women changing, increased selfishness, a society which is much more secular and consumerist, so it doesn't have an investment in the future in the same way. All these things are correct. But basically, I think what it amounts to is a complete loss of hope in the society itself. And that loss of hope is due to a demoralization in the West, partly because of the way in which it's been eroding its own values and culture over so many years. But that itself was caused by a demoralization. I think, and this is a big subject and I have no time to really explore it properly with you today, but I think that a tremendous marker, a tremendous watershed was the Second World War and the fascism that developed in Europe and led to the Holocaust. And I think that led to a real demoralization in every sense of the European mind, that they believed that they were no longer worthy, basically, of existing as a culture. Now, the reason I have a ray of hope is that we see a great tide of protest now developing in Britain and in Europe. In Britain, Britain voted to come out of the European Union. Right. In Europe, we see all sorts of convulsions in terms of politics. And basically, these convulsions are driven by two things, and they're related. One is the desire for the Western nation to reassert itself as a democratic, self-governing entity. And the European Union prevents that, very explicitly prevents that. And the second thing is the related inability of the countries of Europe to control their immigration policies as their own policies. Because the European Union's core belief is that it's basically one big country, and therefore people should be able to cross borders at will. And so you cannot control your immigration policy in France as a French person. Now, with the rise of this great populist movement, as it's called, for national identity, has the capacity to bring back the Western nation. If Britain leaves the European Union, Britain will become again a self-governing nation. That, in my view, is an essential first step to regaining a sense of purpose and identity as a nation, and that is the essential first step to a nation recovering a sense of its own hopefulness in its own future, and that could play into a demographic shift for the better.
When I get back, I do want to talk to you a little bit about, again, your book is a warning to America, to the West, even Canada. It's a warning. I want to bring it a little bit more to this country in my next couple of segments, talking to Melanie Phillips. I'm coming back in just a couple of minutes. Don't go away.
We know you're enjoying the insights today from journalist Melanie Phillips. Week after week, our media team researches guests and material to bring you the best resources to help you discern our times. You can order an audio recording of today's program or any program you hear on Understanding the Times Radio when you phone 763-559-4444. We want you to know we take listener feedback very seriously. We're so thankful when you write with your comments. How are we doing? We value your opinion. Send us your comments or questions. Write to us at olivetreeviews.org or address your mail to Olive Tree Ministries, Post Office Box 1452, Maple Grove, Minnesota 55311. In just a moment, Jan and Eric will return with Melanie Phillips. We are finalizing our 21st Understanding the Times Conference for October 7 at Grace Church in Eden Prairie, Minnesota, just outside of Minneapolis. Please consider joining us from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. There is no cost or registration needed, but you need to make hotel reservations early. Meet believers from across America who take our time seriously, but have a hope and expectancy many do not have. Our speakers include Amir Sarfati.
Thessalonians chapter 4, he says, the dead in Christ will rise first, and then we that are alive will be caught up in the air. In other words, he was completely sure it's going to happen in his lifetime. And that's the way we should live, as if it is going to happen at any given minute.
Dr. Mark Hitchcock.
And to me, that's a great picture of Bible prophecy for us. Knowing what's coming gives you peace of mind. And the Bible tells us that prophecy has a calming influence on our lives.
Pastor J.D. Farag.
That's not to be dismissive of the seriousness of what's happening in the world today, but thankfully we have prophecy in the Bible that tells us not only what's going to happen at the time of the end, but why it's going to happen and where it's going to lead. And by the way, spoiler alert, we win.
Michelle Bachman.
These people don't give up. That's what we don't understand. That is everything for them, is their strategy to get to one world government. And they will do anything, including lawless actions, to get there.
Visit our website for details, olivetreeviews.org. That's olivetreeviews.org. Or call us at 763-559-4444. That's 763-559-4444. 44. Helping you stay informed on issues that could change your life.
So when you get Islamist violence, when you get a Fort Hood, when you get a Boston Massacre, when you get recruitment of young Muslim men born in Britain, the recruitment of those young men to Islamic radicalism, multicultural society stands back and says, we can't say anything about this because it would be racist, it would be Islamophobic, it would be prejudiced because we're multiculturalists. Well, this to me is Western society's suicide note to itself. It's Western society saying we cannot uphold freedom, peace, liberty, equality, decency. Are we really saying that? Of course not. Of course not. So we've got ourselves into this terrible muddle.
The shaping of the political environment in the United Kingdom, Europe, and the United States. That's today's topic on Understanding the Times with journalist Melanie Phillips. Once again, Jan Markell.
On ISIS, nobody, if I decide to run and win, nobody would be tougher than Donald Trump. Nobody. I would hit them so hard and so fast that they wouldn't know what happened. I would find a general Remember the old days of General MacArthur and General Patton and these great generals. Now, we must have somebody in there. But I laugh as I say, and it's laugh through tears, as you say, look, they're announcing when they're going to attack the other side. How often do you see that? In 2 weeks from now, we're sending soldiers over here. We're going to attack this. General MacArthur is spinning in his grave when he sees what we do. So you got to hit him hard. You got to hit him firm. And you can't play games. You got to go hard and fast and firm.
And welcome back. You're listening to Understanding the Times Radio. And I'm happy to have you in studio. Melanie Phillips, author of the book, which I was familiar with a decade ago, Londonistan. Also author of the book, The World Turned Upside Down. And Melanie actually was an ardent leftist. And then she said she was mugged by reality and has become a conservative. And she's on a kind of a cross-country speaking tour. And I'm blessed and privileged to have her in the Twin Cities area. And Melanie, by the way, and as Eric knows, Minnesota is Minnesotistan. This is Little Mogadishu. We have issues here. I have a national audience, but I often refer to the fact that I'm my home base being the Twin Cities. We've got Islamic issues here. It's kind of jihad central. I don't know if you're aware of that.
I have been made more aware of it. I was a little aware of it, but I have been made much more aware of it in the last few days when I've been here.
France recently had an election. They have a new president. There are some in the evangelical community who are looking at him almost as an apocalyptic figure, and I don't say that to be sensational at all. It's just he's a very intriguing figure. You said they perceive him as a centrist. He's not. He's a leftist. Where do you think he could take Europe? Obviously France. We could start with that, but where do you think? France not going to leave the EU, obviously.
Well, he's called a centrist. He's not a centrist in my book.
Right.
To me, he's a fanatical Europhile.
Mm-hmm.
He's somebody who believes that all the answers to all the problems that beleaguer France, in particular Islamization, violent militant Islam, which is causing great violence of the French population on a regular basis, and the allied loss of French national self-government through the fact that it's principal country in the European Union. These two things are linked. France can't control its own immigration policy because it's part of the EU. He thinks that the answer to all these questions and more is more and better and deeper EU. He thinks mm-hmm. that the greater loss of the French ability to govern itself is a solution to all these problems. Emmanuel Macron seems to me not a centrist. He stands for the view of the world, which is globalist, which is internationalist, mm-hmm. which denigrates the nation state, which denigrates the West, which denigrates French culture as a particular culture, and all the rest of it. And this view of the world, which is basically the leftist, progressive, liberal view of the world, however much whatever you like to call it, is the view of the world which I think basically voters in mainland Europe, in Britain and in America have voted against in great number. The precise reasons for their voting are all very different, clearly. Nevertheless, they're basically in revolt against an establishment view which rides roughshod over the desire of ordinary, decent people to live in a country that they recognise as their own culture and to govern it themselves through their own democratically elected parliament, which they can throw out. Now, Macron stands for the opposite of that, and the revolt against that view which almost brought to power Marine Le Pen. Marine Le Pen, who runs the Front National, the National Front, a party which under her father, who was very explicitly anti-Semitic and a neo-fascist type, she has tried to distance herself and her party from him, I think not entirely. But basically, that party was a fringe party, which nobody took seriously until very recently. And the reason why Marine Le Pen nearly became president of France, she lost to Emmanuel Macron in the final runoff, just recently. The reason why she was brought almost to power was because of the very things that Emmanuel Macron, in my view, stands for. So the idea that he's going to solve these problems is false, in my view. In the next 5 years, whatever it is, until the next French presidential election, I think we're going to find the pressures that brought Marine Le Pen to the final runoff in that election are going to increase exponentially. Macron, as a fanatical Europhile, is also deeply hostile to Britain's decision to leave European Union. He has basically said, you know, I'm going to make it as difficult as possible and I'm going to punish them. This ban, you know, is an enemy of democracy. The British people have a right to say that they wish to govern themselves. He doesn't understand that. Yeah. He doesn't understand what democratic self-government is, quite obviously. So I think he's a potential menace quite frankly, not a centrist at all.
We have the same kind of fanatical going on here in our streets. People that can't take the election, take the effects of the election and so on. And we're watching this happen in the streets. I think it's going to get worse, honestly. Three questions, and these are big ones maybe. Do you have any idea what nation may be the next one to try to bolt from the euro? And I guess I would ask then, is there a possibility of a nation falling to Islamic control inside the euro? And will the European community, in the end, will it survive?
Last question first, no. In the end, no. The European Union is founded on a whole series of incompatible premises, of which the most glaring is the idea that you can have a common currency, the euro, serving every nation when these are independent nations and you don't have a common culture. It's not like the United States, where you have one country, one nation, united by all the things that unite a nation. And consequently, this discrepancy, dislocation between the currency and the politics means that the whole European Union project is bound to collapse, plus the appalling pressures that it's inflicted upon itself by its open borders policy, the demographic changes that are taking place, the huge influx of immigrants, which it simply cannot sustain. So I wouldn't expect it to last for very long. I don't know when it's going to implode. If a major country were to leave, in addition to Britain, I think it would be its death knell if France were to leave, which there's no prospect of it now doing so under this new president, Emmanuel Macron, but it could do so if, for example, Marine Le Pen came to power at the next French presidential election. That would collapse the European Union completely. As far as which nation might be the next to bolt the European Union or the euro, and which might be one that becomes basically a Muslim country, I really can't tell you that. I just can't predict this kind of thing.
If you'd like to learn more, visit Melanie's website, melaniephillips.com, melaniephillips.com. You can find her books at amazon.com. And Melanie, I played a little teaser a couple minutes ago, and that was a soundbite of Donald Trump saying that he would be tough on ISIS. And ISIS has certainly changed the face of the Middle East, a couple of nations over there. It's actually changed the face of Europe. That's why a lot of those refugees, some of them anyway, are fleeing. Some are coming to America. Do you feel that ISIS could be defeated?
I think ISIS can certainly be defeated. I mean, I'm not a military strategist, but I read military strategists who say that ISIS is not a particular problem in terms of military capability at all. It's not particularly strong. It's in fact very weak. And with the right kind of policy and military strategy and determination, it can easily be defeated. And I don't think ISIS is the main problem at all. I think it's obviously a very, very serious terrorist threat to the entire world. But the problem of Islamist terror and Islamization well predated ISIS, and after ISIS is defeated, which I fully expect it to be, there will be others who will rise to take its place. The problem is the particular way of thinking in the Islamic world, which is giving rise to this twin-headed hydra of, on the one hand, terrorism, and on the other, cultural encroachment and takeover, which is basically the Islamic Jihad. And that requires a great deal of statesmanship and courage and far-sightedness, determination to address.
But we at least, America at least, has a president willing to say that the root cause is radical Islam. We didn't have that for 8 years.
You have a president who has certainly said that, and I'm sure he believes that, and I'm pretty sure he'll say it again. But among his people that he's appointed to his administration are people who say that this is unhelpful to say this. General McMaster is on record as saying that to use the word Islamic extremism or Islamic terrorism is unhelpful, that Islamic State itself is not Islamic. This is ridiculous. This is ludicrous. And this is part of the mindset that denies that Islamic fanatical Islam is what it is. And if you deny something, you can't defeat it. And, you know, it's a tall order to defeat this thing from inside a country. It's already made such inroads into the fabric of American society the way that it has.
Indeed. As a matter of fact, let me just read something here. And I said moments ago, I live in Minnesotistan. It's also called Little Mogadishu, as you acknowledged. You've become more aware of that since you've been in the state here. And I think this is coming to a neighborhood of a lot of listeners. In this part of the country, at least in Minnesota, 165 Islamic centers, societies, mosques, prayer spaces, Minnesota, stretching from south to north. This number includes 21 Muslim student associations on Minnesota college campuses, 11 Muslim student associations in various high schools. The number does not include extensive Islamic parallel society, Islamic schools, clinics, media, daycare doesn't count. Under the noses of Minnesota leaders and law enforcement, Minnesota has also become the hub for promotion, recruitment, and financing of Islamic terror. In fact, we have been known as the Jihadi Pipeline for about the last 10 years. Now, I think that's coming to a neighborhood all over the country. Would I be right there?
I don't know whether this is going to happen. I don't live here, but I do think that there is the possibility that it could extend to other parts of the country if things aren't addressed properly. And the reason why this is all happening, not just here, but also the way it's happened in Britain, is that the way in which our societies have responded to the threat has actually encouraged people to take advantage of the weaknesses of the society to make these cultural inroads. Now, in Britain, it took different forms from here. We have a different political system here. But here, for example, you have a highly politicized system in which you are run as a state by a governor. The governor may be at odds with the people at a lower level of the administration, who I think Minnesota are trying to deal with this problem, but are up against, you know, a Democrat governor. So you're stuck because you can't actually do anything with a governor who actually is not on the same page. And I'm also struck by the fact that much of your law enforcement apparatus, your justice apparatus, is similarly highly politicized. And consequently, you are paralyzed by the fact that so many of your court officials, if I can put it that way, your judicial authorities, acting politically, not in the interests of the country, not in the interests of the society or the state, but in the interests of an ideology which governs their political affiliation. Now, that is a very difficult thing, obviously, to deal with. It can be only dealt with in a democratic way. But basically, it requires, you know, the federal government, it requires president, it requires Congress to draw some lines in the sand here. First of all, the law must be upheld. And it must be one law for all. It must be the law of the land is the law. Yeah. Without that, a liberal democratic society cannot exist as a society. You cannot have parallel laws. And that fact must be upheld. And that means, I think, that a society that, like Britain, like America, should basically say this. It should say to Muslims, look, as Muslims, you're welcome here. You're welcome to form your communities of faith. You're welcome to worship in your mosques. You're welcome to form neighborhoods where you are associated with like-minded people in your communities of faith and your culture. That's fine. But you have to do so on the same basis as everybody else. Every minority, every immigrant, everyone knows that they are in this country on the same basis as each other, which is that we all observe one law for all. And consequently, we cannot have a parallel jurisdiction. Now, the problem with Sharia law, Islamic religious law, is that unlike any other community of faith, this is a religious doctrine which requires a set of religious laws to be imposed which do not recognize any superior secular authority. And therefore, Sharia law in and of itself is incompatible with a democratic Western society. So you're welcome here, but you cannot have Sharia law because that fundamentally goes against the basic principle of this society. If you're here, you have to be here on the same basis as everybody else. There can be no discrimination against you and no discrimination in favor of you. And consequently, this is the line in the sand. No Sharia law, and I would say no extremism. So no Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood should be banned. And that means that the Muslim Brotherhood, which is entrenched in a society like this in America, it's entrenched in Britain through its numerous subsidiary organizations, right, either sponsors directly or its seeds in the sense of providing the personnel with the ideology of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is one of takeover of the West. That has to be banned. And if you were to ban that, and that has to be done at the highest level of the state, then you would actually help remove the propitious circumstances which encourage people to move in and try and take over.
Well, you know, in Canada, we're hearing that in some jurisdictions, that Sharia law is being considered and maybe even used. And I want to ask that even though there's no way to really project and say, well, you know, where it's going to go, the progression of the way that Muslims have come in and now they've gone from just becoming a community of people in a neighborhood to having no-go zones where police are told not to go, whether it'd be dangerous for them to go. I think we see the same progression happening here that has happened in Great Britain by what I've read. And if you confirm that, that'd be great.
Well, it's not true that we have no-go zones like that in Britain. But, you know, there is no place in Britain, as far as I know, where the police will not go. But the development of the these threatening neighborhoods and the development of a kind of separate culture within a culture is the fault of the host community, which has allowed this to happen because it's too frightened to draw lines in the sand, because it tells itself, because we're the West and we believe that, you know, people of faith should be tolerated and they should be able to have the freedom to practice their faith. And that's absolutely correct. Muslims should be able to practice their faith insofar as the faith is a private matter. But mm-hmm. the problem is that the radical interpretation of Islam means that it's not a private matter, it becomes a public matter. It means that it is interpreted in a way which basically collides headfirst with the basic premises of a democratic society. Mm-hmm. Yep. And that's where a democratic society is entitled to say, as I said before, you're welcome here to practice mm-hmm. your faith, but on the same basis as every other minority, cannot have special treatment. And it's the inability of us to say that and to tolerate what should not be tolerated that has encouraged people to move in literally and metaphorically mm-hmm. and try and take over the society, because it's open for takeover. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you draw lines in the sand, you will discourage that.
Well, going back to the problems here in America, I mean, it doesn't help. And again, the PC, politically correct issues and all, doesn't help when we've got public schools who are having hijab day and we celebrate diversity in the schools. We observe Islamic holidays. I mean, we would never observe a Christian holiday, but we observe its Islamic holidays in the schools. And I saw a headline here, New York public schools promote course justifying suicide bombings. You've got the progressive left running our school system and brainwashing our kids, which is one of the reasons we have the problem that we have, is because of our educational system. I mean, I'm reading it every day about what the public school system is demanding that students, their students, do on a regular basis. I'm out of time in this segment. We'll pick it up here when we come back in just a couple of minutes.
Understanding the Times Radio is a listener-underwritten broadcast ministry. That means the only way we can remain on the air is through your generous financial gifts. During the summer months, we usually find our support dropping somewhat. We need more listeners to help sustain us through June, July, and August. Please consider becoming a part of our growing support family. Many see this ministry as a critical resource contributing to their spiritual awareness. If that describes you, we invite you to mail your tax-deductible gifts to Olive Tree Ministries, Post Office Box 1452, Maple Grove, Minnesota 55311. You can also give by phone at 763-559-4444 or securely online at olivetreeviews.org. Please stay with us. Jen and Eric will return shortly with journalist Melanie Phillips.
I have often called Understanding the Times Radio, Radio for the Remnant. Around the world, people have had enough of fake news, slanted news, and evidence that good people are marginalized and unappreciated. That is why this program focuses on the truth and the ultimate good news. If you would like to keep it coming to your neighborhood, please consider a tax-deductible gift to Olive Tree Ministries. Give online at olivetreeviews.org, olivetreeviews.org. You can call us business hours, Central Time, 763-559-4444, 763-559-4444, or just drop us a note. If you can't financially support, let us know we make a difference in your life. Write to Olive Tree Ministries, Box 1452, Maple Grove, Minnesota 55311, Box 1452, Maple Grove, Minnesota 55311. Help us look at today, but with another eye on tomorrow and the ultimate hope that awaits us. Folks, this ministry has written a little end time study guide. Are we living in the last days? For your neighborhood group in your church interested in these topics, you can cover it in 12 weeks. It's got built-in questions in the study guide. Check it out in my store, olivetreeviews.org. It's in all of my newsletters, print and e-newsletters, or give my office a call. It's $9 for one copy. You can get 10 copies for $60. And those who have an interest in this topic, you can just have a 12-week study, and it's not detailed, it's not complicated. This is Jan Markell. Silence on the uncomfortable themes facing our world is not defending the truth. The inconvenient truth must be told if we are to understand our times. Thank you for being with us each week here on this radio station.
Now, let's wrap up today's discussion with Melanie Phillips as Understanding the Times continues. Here again, Jan Markell.
And welcome back. And let me just quickly make a brief announcement, a couple of things I want to say. And you can always access this program on my website Saturday morning, olivetreeviews.org, olivetreeviews.org. And let me just quickly say that I will be teaching a Sunday evening Bible prophecy class, June, July, and August, 6:30 to 8 p.m. We're renting the facilities of Kehillat Tzar Shalom Messianic Congregation in St. Louis Park on Rhode Island. That's the former Twin City Fellowship Church, the former Twin City Fellowship. Everyone welcome, no cost, no registration. Sunday evening, June, July, August. My national audience, thank you for allowing me to make a local announcement. But we are prophecy deprived here in the Twin Cities area, so it's something I try to do in the summers. It'll be Sunday evening, Kehillat Tzar Shalom, St. Louis Park. Eric, you had a comment during the break, and I wanted you to be able to get that in.
Our politically correct society has caused us really to bend over backwards not to offend a religion whose printed book, the Quran, tells them not to assimilate. Mm-hmm. And yet we're trusting somehow that we're going to convince them by our goodness to assimilate, to be a Quranic Muslim, you can't assimilate. And that to me has been one of the craziest things along the way, where you have judges trying to, you know, reform terrorists and all those kind of things. This is not part of the thinking of Islam, I'm afraid to say.
So pleased to have in studio Melanie Phillips, again, author of the books Londonistan and The World Turned Upside Down. I believe you have another one called Guardian Angel. You'd have to find them on Amazon.com. Don't call here. We don't have them. Amazon.com. Learn more at MelaniePhillips.com. I gave a tease a few minutes ago, Melanie, about wanting to talk to you about Donald Trump, about Israel. We have all new Israel-U.S. relations. We have a president, in spite of some of his shortcomings, who has a heart for Israel, and I think you would agree to that.
Very much so. I think he has a genuine affection for Israel, a genuine desire to protect it. He is certainly a welcome change from what's been the case in the last 8 years under President Obama, who I believe had an animosity, deep animosity against Israel and endangered it. And we see that President Trump has already done some things which help Israel. He has indicated to Iran that he is not happy with the Iran deal, which I think endangers the entire world. Quite how he will deal with this problem of the terrible Iran deal remains to be seen, but at least he has laid it down that he is unhappy with that state of affairs and he wishes to rein back the increasing power of Iran. He has also put a wonderful person into the United Nations, Ambassador Nikki Haley, who for the first time in my lifetime is somebody who is standing up in the United Nations and telling them that their irrational and really quite deranged animosity towards the state of Israel is completely unacceptable. Again, we have to see the United States putting its money where its mouth is. I would like to see it withdrawing money from the United Nations as a result of its ridiculous and dangerous attitude towards Israel. But that's a tremendous advance. Now, in terms of Israel and the Palestinians, there's a lot of confusion and concern among certain people in Israel itself and among people who support Israel that President Trump has been too friendly to the Palestinians, given that the Palestinians, in my view and in the view of many, have a non-negotiable agenda, one of basically wishing to destroy the state of Israel as a Jewish homeland. Mm-hmm. So why is President Trump making nice with them? Well, we don't yet know. It's possible that he is going down the same peace process rabbit hole that has entrapped successive administrations, but it's also possible that he's giving the Palestinians rope with which to hang their own cause. He invited Mahmoud Abbas to the White House. It was all very friendly and very loving and very nice, but he set the Palestinians a very high bar for them, which is basically they've got to stop teaching their children to hate and to murder Jews. They've got to stop paying the terrorists' families salaries for blowing up and murdering Jews. And this is a high bar for them because basically he's saying, we expect you to be a civilized people. We expect you to actually want to live alongside the state of Israel, not destroy it. Can you show us that is the case? And so far, the Palestinians have said, you must be kidding. You mad? We're not going to do this. So now the question will be, given that Mr. Trump, the President Trump, by his own lights, wishes to preside over a deal. He wishes to bring about the deal of deals and bring about peace between Israel and the Arabs. Okay, is he going to understand that on this particular issue, There can be no deal. You can make no deal Absolutely. With the unspeakable agenda. You cannot negotiate with the non-negotiable. If you try and make a deal with an agenda which is unconscionable, then you end up being the handmaid to evil. And I don't think he's going to do that. So the question is, what's he going to do when it becomes quite clear the Palestinians are not going to meet his requirements? What's he going to do? I think I know what he should do. I don't know what he's going to do.
Tell us what he should do.
What he should do is say, you know what? I'm the deal maker. And as the deal maker, I know what makes a deal. And I have said in The Art of the Deal that sometimes a deal is not possible. And I'm telling you, as the deal maker in chief of the world, this is an issue where a deal isn't possible for this reason, that you cannot make a deal with people whose basic premise, whose basic proposition is one that no civilized person should accept at all, and that is the destruction of the State of Israel. And so, therefore, given that you, the Palestinians, are still set on this appalling aim, there will be no deal from me, no negotiation at all. You will get nothing from America. You will get no money. You will get no diplomatic recognition. We will no longer regard you as statesmen in waiting. You are not. You are terrorist supporters and people who wish to exterminate another people. As such, you'll be treated as political and diplomatic pariahs. When and if you change that agenda, we're open for discussion, for a deal, for a negotiation. But insofar as you have an agenda which no civilized person can tolerate, then you are out of here. That's what he should be saying. He should be changing the entire narrative. Until now, well-meaning administrations have said this is a fight over land, over the division of land between two peoples with a claim to the same piece of land. Not true.
Not true.
For 100 years, this has been a fight which has been caused by the desire of the Arab side to exterminate the Jewish homeland. And furthermore, what they're always trying to do is to rob the Jewish people of its own history, to pretend that the Jewish people, who are the only people for whom the land of Israel was ever their national kingdom in history, that they are pretending that that isn't the case and that the Palestinians were there first. Historical illiteracy of a high order. Unfortunately, many in the West who are ignorant of Judaism, of the Bible, they're ignorant of history, they're ignorant of the Middle East, they have bought into this in large measure and they believe it. So it needs the President of the United States to reshape the entire narrative of the Middle East, to start educating the world in what is actually going on in the Middle East, and to start standing up for truth, for history, and for doing the right thing, for justice, against the lies and the falsehoods and the extermination agenda that has held sway for all these decades.
Yes. If you could have a private meeting with President Donald Trump, I suspect you would say some of the things you've just said.
I would certainly say it to him, and I would relish the chance, if I ever had the opportunity, to sit down and say, Mr. President, I believe your instincts in this are entirely good, but people around you, even Jewish counselors that you have, the Jewish advisors you have, they may not have told you this in the terms that you need to hear it, and I will.
And you have stated that you were mugged by reality, you were a liberal, you became much more conservative. You address Jewish groups all the time, and how do they receive some of what you're saying, which may not be in keeping with the traditional Jewish more liberal opinion?
Well, there's tremendous pushback against the views that I have in the Jewish world, particularly in America, where 75% of the identifying Jewish community votes Democrat. And that's a whole different story. That's another story quite why they are wedded to this. But they're basically wedded to it, I think, because they have secularized Jewish religious ethics and have departed, therefore.
Do they even care about Israel?
The number who care is diminishing. As their attachment to the religious ethics of Judaism is becoming more attenuated, so in direct proportion to that, their attachment to the State of Israel is becoming weaker, and their children are becoming being turned by the prevailing liberal progressive zeitgeist that they get from the media, in particular from the universities. Their children are being turned hostile. So this is a very difficult situation. It's happening in Britain, but not in the same way, not to the same degree.
As a culture loses its way morally and forgets the basis of its faith, and we're watching that happen inside the Jewish community, exactly what she just said. And you can't help but think about the 60s and free love trying to fill a void because we didn't feel good about ourselves, and now look what's happened to us.
I would just like to say that I live in two worlds, the world of Israel and the world of Britain. Mm-hmm. I have places in both, and I go back and forward. I live a rather complicated life.
Yeah.
And I think what we all have to appreciate and acknowledge, and you in America appreciate this much more than we do in Britain, but America and Israel are all basically on the same side and fighting the same fight. Israel is often put in a different box from the West. It's perceived as fighting a different kind of fight because it's a fight over land. It's not the same. It's not a different fight at all. It's the same fight. Israel is absolutely central to the recovery of the West, the recovery of the West's belief in itself and, mm-hmm. and of Western values. Because at the heart of the decline of Western values is the assault on the precepts of the Hebrew Bible.
Yeah.
You know, a secular society that departs from those precepts turns on itself. And the way in which we see so many in the progressive circles in the West demonizing and delegitimizing Israel to try mm-hmm. and destroy it, there's also a tremendous outburst of anti-Semitism going on in Britain and in Europe. These things are all connected. And until and unless the West actually realizes that Israel is not simply crucial in a military and intelligence way for the defense of the West, being forward arm, as it were, the forward salient of the West in the Middle East, and absolutely crucial militarily to the West from that point of view, but Israel also represents and embodies in itself the core values that the West needs for itself to survive. And so mm-hmm. we're all in this together.
MelaniePhillips.com. Get a lot more information there. The two books I would recommend, Londonistan, The World Turned Upside Down. Find them at Amazon.com. Not here, Amazon.com. Londonistan, The World Turned Upside Down. Those are two distinct books. And let me just thank you for stopping by the studio. I know you've got a travel schedule, and I'm honored to have you here. Appreciate so much what you do, what you stand for, and what you write particularly.
It's entirely my pleasure. Thank you so much for having
me. You know, the Bible calls the last days perilous times. The passage in 2 Timothy 3 says that these days would grow more and more godless. We see secular humanism, atheism rising around the world. Freedom is being replaced with socialism and totalitarianism. While we have time, please share the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ, while we are still able to do so. I want to thank you for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for joining us for today's Understanding the Times Radio with Jan Markell. We continue to reach the world by reporting current events from a biblical perspective. Costing us thousands of dollars, this listener-supported program is delivered each weekend nationwide and into your home. You can help us produce and distribute this broadcast. We invite you to partner with this ministry. With our ever-changing world, men and women of faith need to be aware of current events as reported and discussed through the lens of Scripture. With the blessed hope in view, each week Jan Markell brings you compelling guest interviews to highlight the dangers in today's world. To become our broadcast partner, please write with your tax-deductible gifts to Olive Tree Ministries, Post Office Box 1452, Maple Grove, Minnesota 55311. You can also help underwrite this program safely and securely at olivetreeviews.org or when you phone 763-559-4444. We're looking forward to hearing from you this week, and please continue to pray for the Olive Tree Ministries team. For daily global updates with a biblical worldview 24 hours a day, log on to olivetreeviews.org. Next week, Jan returns with another program designed to help you understand the times.